Numerous reports indicate that manufacturing has emerged as the favorite target of ransomware groups and hackers. In response, a new report from Industrial Media discusses the evolution of industrial cybersecurity, its current state, and the tactics hackers are using, including phishing schemes, malware, and ransomware attacks. It also details solutions and arming manufacturers with the knowledge and resources needed to win more fights on this highly complex and ultra-competitive battlefield. Download the industrial sector's new battlefield by going to manufacturing.net/cyber. Hi, I'm Jeff Ranke, Editorial Director of Manufacturing.net and Manufacturing Business Technology. Welcome to Security Breach. The manufacturing sector has become a showcase for technological evolution in a number of ways, with cybersecurity being one of the most recent examples. While many in the sector cheered with the recent crackdown on groups like Lockbit, the reality is that many of these victories are short-lived. For example, after law enforcement seized control of multiple Lockbit websites and stolen data, the group was back to running extortion campaigns within a week. And the same can be said for other high-profile busts of groups like Hive and Volt Typhoon. These groups rebuild or rebrand, as was the case with the Conti Group offshoot Black Basta. After Conti disbanded, Black Basta reformed from the ashes and tallied over $100 million in ransomware payments last year. My point is not to belittle the incredible work that global agencies are performing as they go after these criminals, but to illustrate that while the industrial sector continues to make tremendous gains in securing the OT environment and winning more battles than in the past, the war continues. And as we evolve and improve, so will the bad guys. And perhaps no one knows this better than my guest for today's episode. It's my pleasure to welcome Rod Locke to the show. He's the Director of Project Management at Fortinet, a leading provider of OT cybersecurity solutions. So Rod, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate you taking the time and welcome to Security Breach.
I'm really happy to be here.
Awesome. You know, we had a chance to talk a little bit before sitting down just now, and you've seen a lot of developments in the field of industrial cybersecurity, and I thought that might be an interesting place to start in terms of talking about just some of the evolutions you've witnessed from both the defensive side as well as some of the things that the bad guys are doing differently nowadays.
For sure. And, you know, I somehow got into this field 17 years ago, and a lot of things have changed over those 17 years, and some things haven't changed. So some of the challenges people look at today, it could have come from a conference in 2008, where you say, well, you've got these legacy PLCs and people aren't replacing them for 20 years. And you know, you have vulnerabilities in that environment. There's some, on the other hand, there's some huge things that have changed both in how people are connecting to those systems. So they're trying to do things like digital transformation and can't rely on an air gap anymore. You also have huge changes in the threat landscape. So in 2008 ransomware, I don't know that the term had even been coined yet. Some of the nation state attacks hadn't happened yet. And then even more recently on the attacker side, you've got things like nation state aligned attacks. You've got things that are aligned with the Ukraine conflict. You've got things that are aligned with the Israel-Gaza warfare that's happening right now. So even within the last year, within the last 2 years, things have changed a lot.
You know, I'm glad you brought that up, sort of with the international dynamic, and a lot of these state-sponsored organizations are sort of accidentally stumbling into the industrial sector. They're going after more government or what they would consider infrastructure-type targets, but those are industrial control systems that are obviously used throughout manufacturing as well. What can we take away there? What are we learning from some of those attacks, or how are we getting better as a result maybe of being exposed to some of those hackers?
Yeah, it's a really, a worrying trend, especially in North American critical infrastructure, that you have, most recently, threat actors that are attributed to being aligned with China, doing some intrusions into critical infrastructure organizations, not necessarily doing anything malicious yet, but kind of exfiltrating information about the environment. And it doesn't seem to be the sort of traditional sort of corporate espionage, trade secret theft that maybe previous groups would have done, but it seems to be more understanding the critical infrastructure in the United States and understanding how they can maybe lay the groundwork or if they need to do something later on. So it's a lot more aligned with what we would have seen from groups like, Sandworm or the the sort of Kremlin-aligned groups were doing starting in 2014 in Ukraine.
So is this kind of a reemergence or maybe a growth in, like we call it, those live-off-the-land or dwelling type of attacks? Are you seeing more of those sort of taking root right now?
Yeah, we've seen. So it's a higher level of sophistication when we start seeing that type of attack, right? Rather than showing up with your own malware that's kind of a Swiss Army knife of capabilities, you show up and say, okay, what tools are lying around the shop? And I'm going to maintain my persistence using only some scripts and some tools that are already in this router that I've taken over or already in this IP camera that I've taken over that's inside the environment. So it allows them to have a much longer dwell time. I think with Volt Typhoon, what the news stories are saying, what the analysts have said, is that it was up to 5 years inside some of these environments without being detected. It's sort of mind-boggling. We find out about campaigns like this later on, obviously. Like, this kind of thing happens all the time. And I'm sure, you know, the North American and Five Eyes intelligence services are probably doing similar stuff and maybe also not getting caught for a long time. But these kinds of techniques really help with, you know, as a defender, you're not looking for malware running in your environment. You're not looking for files that you can identify or run in a sandbox. You know, the attacker's got access, but they haven't really installed anything on the unit. So it's much harder to pick it up.
No, those are very scary when you think about what they can get into and probably for how long they can be there, just sort of picking their timing, essentially, for what they want to do. What do we learn about this then from a defensive perspective? Does this place a greater emphasis on things like really looking at the remote access that we're giving, or whether it's double factor authentication, or going more deeply and just looking at the way we segment our network in order to ensure we have the proper security protocols, we can respond more quickly? What are some things that we're learning from these types of attacks specifically, I guess?
Yeah, I think from some of the TTPs that we're seeing from that specific campaign, beyond the sort of living off the land aspect of it, I think we're seeing that, we've been, anybody who's done corporate security training in the last 10 years has spent a lot of time, you know, reviewing how not to click on phishing emails, right? Yeah. And that's not necessarily involved here at all. What they're doing is actually good old fashioned, penetration, where they're looking for exposed services, exposed applications, exposed credentials, and not necessarily, there may be some sort of alignment, not necessarily overlap, but we've seen related compromises of SaaS applications and some of the managed file transfer applications where there are some, not necessarily crown jewel information that was picked off, but because there was this ability to do mass compromise, there's this huge data set out there of anything you might have accidentally leaked about how your environments are set up. So I think if anything, what's old is new again in some ways, because it's not all about phishing anymore. It's now, people can just go straight in via an exposed entry point, that external attack surface that people were maybe de-emphasizing for so many years. And you should still not click on phishing emails, by the way.
Yeah, absolutely. Does this, when you first started talking about this, what this really brings up to me is, and we talked about all the influx of connection points, this expanding attack surface that's going on here. Does some of this resonate from the fact that we've got a lot of legacy systems connecting to new technology? Or again, is this just the hackers just probing and finding soft spots?
I think it's more the latter. I don't know that so the one incident late last year that's more aligned with the Israel-Gaza conflict and hacktivism attributed to or aligned with Iran was, okay, you've got some exposed PLCs, people have given them public IP addresses, and they left the default credentials on. I mean, it's kind of just like ticking every box of what not to do. And some of those got hit, and not in a way that the attackers necessarily pivoted elsewhere in the environment. They just put up a message saying, we've hacked your PLC because we're angry at Israel and this PLC is from Israel. I wouldn't call it like a low sophistication attack, but like the attackers weren't really doing anything. They weren't leveraging that to do anything else really in those attacks that we know of. But it's a good wake-up call that kind of thing is still possible. I think in general, the legacy systems that are connected, the legacy system isn't really the vulnerable entry point still. There's usually some kind of router that's sitting in front of them. And if there's going to be some kind of entry point, whether it comes across laterally from elsewhere in the organization, or whether it comes directly from the internet because there's an exposed service on that router that somebody's figured out how to exploit, that's how they're getting access and able to do reconnaissance into those environments.
Interesting. You know, so in trying to get better in defending against those types of vulnerabilities, is this a training issue? Is this a framework issue? Is this a planning dynamic? What would be the first step potentially in trying to identify those things before they become a big problem?
I would say for that class, that type of attack specifically, and that type of technique of going, you know, straight into some of these devices and some of these smaller sites, part of it points to, I think, a lack of management of these devices in some cases, where often the patches that would have closed those vulnerabilities have been available for some time on those devices. So, I mean, the same kind of issue you would see in OT environments, sometimes because that's a remote OT site, it's actually, it may be the OT security team or the operations team that's managing that and saying, well, we're reluctant to patch that router that's providing access to that pump station because we're not sure what's going to happen after the patch. And I've dealt with this when I've been on the product security side, where you get the patches out there and people say, thank you, we'll think about it, and we might patch it in 2 years. So I think there's an aspect of that, and not having sort of central management and visibility of all those devices that you've got out there. I think people are sometimes deploying these kinds of routers as sort of a point solution to solve a problem at those sites, and not thinking about how it's really part of their, not just their kind of network architecture, but their OT security posture, and just thinking about, well, I just need this to solve a connectivity problem. And then you kind of deploy and forget. And maybe you're even paying attention to all those devices. Maybe you even have OT visibility of some of those devices in that site, but you're not necessarily keeping that external attack surface updated the way you maybe need to.
No, that's a great point. And what I'm wondering then is that the result potentially of sort of taking those IT approaches and trying to apply them to the OT environment, which we know that does not always work?
I think there's a little bit of both, actually. And I know that people in OT love to tell horror stories of how IT has installed things that blew up their environment. I think with these types of devices, in some cases, it's actually the operational networking team that maybe is that owned those networks up, or maybe used to own those networks, and they weren't really part of the remit even of the CISO. One thing that we've seen with Fortinet, we do an annual survey of operational technology security professionals and practitioners specifically. And one thing that we've seen is a very strong trend towards OT security being part of the remit of the CISO. So they may not make every decision, and they might have a converged SOC even, where all incidents are flowing up to the same SOC. The SOC may not have OT expertise. They may still phone back to the plant and say, hey, we saw this alert, you know, can you tell us what's going on there? But I think in some cases, it's really, it might have actually been the operational networking team that installed that, you know, that set up the network the way it is, right? So I think organizations, in some organizations are moving beyond this kind of divide even, where they just view it as we're responsible for all these networks. We need to look at the requirements for these different types of networks, these different types of systems in terms of availability, so that you're not just saying well, thou shalt patch instantly and maybe knock something offline. It's, you know, equally bad to just blindly apply all the patches. But yeah, I think that's, I don't want to lay the blame at the feet of IT every time.
No, fair enough. Absolutely. And I think it's a convergence of these two sort of silos beginning to work together more and trying to figure out that process and what makes the most sense.
For sure. And it's a little bit, a lot of it is IT being able to understand what the needs of OT are, and often understanding that, you know, IT has this, from the IT side, they often have this mentality of sort of shoot first, ask questions later, shut it down if you don't know what's going on. In the OT environment, you've got plant managers who are responsible for keeping production online. And, you know, in like in a lot of like commercial companies, they're the ones making the money. So you've got to, you're responsible to keep things operating, keep manufacturing moving, keep your processes moving. And as IT, I need to understand that mindset as well in terms of their, an adjustment from what they do for somebody's laptop, where they, you know, detect some malware on the laptop, it's going offline right away.
Yeah. You know, you mentioned the report. I've looked at that report. It's a fantastic piece of information. We'll definitely link to it in the description of this episode. Maybe, you know, I think most people out there are familiar with Fortinet on some level, but maybe you could talk us through a little bit about some of the areas that you're focused on and how they're helping industrial cybersecurity right now.
Yeah. So specifically, I'm part of the product management team at Fortinet. And what we do is, Fortinet has a lot of different solutions. I think people know Fortinet best for network firewalls and next-gen firewalls. So part of what the OT team does is create ruggedized versions of those using the same ASIC acceleration technology that Fortinet uses across all the product lines. And that means that you get enterprise-grade next-gen firewall in a ruggedized package, and you can put it on a DIN rail, you can put it in a small cabinet, and take advantage of all those threat protections. For the FortiGates, when people deploy FortiGate next-gen firewalls, often they might also deploy a non-rugged version. We see those even be included in large OT systems where the control cabinet has enough climate control. They don't need that, you know, minus 40 to plus 75 C ruggedized device. What we also spend a lot of time on is features for OT security practitioners, whether it's in our next-gen firewalls, switches, our security operations products like our FortiSIM. So we're providing dashboards and analytics and reporting for different security standards, for example. So if somebody's tracking to NERC-SIP or they're tracking to 62443, we can pull all the data out of the security fabric, as we call it, and surface everything that's relevant for their compliance, their compliance posture, to help them be prepared for an audit or to show compliance against those standards.
Makes sense. You know, you brought up a lot, you know, you're talking about standards here a little bit. And one of the things I wanted to pick your brain about too, is a lot of the recent regulatory actions that have been taken. We saw some things initially from the Biden administration. It was all part of the Reinvestment Act. We've seen some more recent things come down from the SEC that relegates companies to be very transparent about ransomware attacks. There's a bunch of stuff going on in the EU. What's your take there in terms of, are we on the right path, I guess, in terms of mandating some of this reporting as it relates to cyber attacks? Should we scale back a little bit, or what's your take?
I think that we may have swung too far in terms of the SEC reporting timelines. Some of those are pretty stringent in terms of, even if you're trying to understand an incident, having to, you know, make that call and get something public within that such a short time period can be a little tough. I've been in an organization that's been through a cybersecurity attack, and it's not necessarily the something you want to add to your plate in terms of when you're trying to, you know, get the factories back online. I would say around the world, I would say we're still in the era of standards not being as maybe aligned as we would like. I think the hope was with 62443 that more countries would align to that set of standards. And so whether it was Singapore, Australia, Japan, China, you'd see more people essentially aligning to that standard, so that for the automation vendors or anybody producing product, anybody offering services, that they could target that standard and meet a lot of different jurisdictions around the world. I think we're still seeing a little more balkanization, like a little bit more differences in standards around the world. So today, if you're a global automation vendor, you're probably still tracking, you know, upwards of 100 different applicable cybersecurity standards, which is probably, it's going to be painful for everybody. So I guess my hope with the industry is that we sort of get gradually more aligned over time, and then we can argue about what should be in and out of the standards. I think in general, 62443 it's on the more prescriptive side, but it's I think a lot of the measures that are in there are pretty reasonable.
My take has always been less government involvement is better in most cases. I think government is good at getting the ball rolling, but I'd like to see them turn things over to industry a little bit more, especially going forward. We have the ingrained expertise to make this happen. Do you think that's the path forward, or do we need government pushing us along a little bit more?
I think so my take on this, and you see the difference in this between like the electrical sector that's had NERC for many years, and oil and gas, which is can barely being touched by regulation, just maybe with the advent of TSA that they've started to get they've th some of their operations are have some kind of conform some kind of requirements on them. I think every sector needs to realize that if you do a bad enough job and if it starts to make the news, the government's going to come up with something for you, right? And so the approach taken by oil and gas, because it's inherently it's a global industry. And so I think they've very successfully made the argument for years that they're better off coming up with good standards and self-regulating at a global level rather than having different requirements around the world. I do think different jurisdictions have started to question that, and so maybe they're putting, they're putting extra requirements for within specific countries, right? But I don't so much. I kind of agree with you that government regulation can end up being the wrong regulation pretty quickly, right? They can end up with the wrong targets, but we've seen that the only thing pushing anybody towards improving their cybersecurity posture over the last maybe 10 to 15 years has really been the threat of cybercrime, mostly. Even something like Stuxnet, most organizations sort of looked at that and said, well, like, there's nobody motivated enough to come and attack my, I've got a potato chip factory. Nobody's motivated enough to come and attack my potato chip factory with a multi-billion dollar cybersecurity attack. So I think cybercrime really woke everybody up, and the fact that all these groups have these kind of affiliate models where they can really scale to smaller and smaller targets, it's really changed the threat landscape for a lot of OT organizations.
No, I agree that the complexity of these organizations, I think, has woken everybody up to the fact that you're on their radar regardless of your size, location, etc. And I think the government, like I said, their initial push was positive. I'd agree with them scaling back a little bit and letting industry take a bigger role here. Rod, I'd like to get your take on a couple of other topics that are really prevalent right now in cybersecurity. The big one, which I'm sure most people are tired of talking about, but there's always an interesting take on it, and that's artificial intelligence. I think it's been proven there's even positive ground on for the good guys. There's a lot of stuff we need to be aware of and how the hackers are going to use it. What's your take maybe just on AI, best uses going forward, or maybe some trends you're seeing?
Sure. I would say in general, if you're looking at attacker capabilities, things like large language models are like gold in terms of like writing really good phishing emails for one thing. Any kind of phishing, social engineering, it makes it a lot easier. It takes away the translation burden. Phishing emails used to be terrible because they're, the English wasn't very good, right? And that's not a problem for anybody anymore, right? Especially with LLMs. The other thing that I guess is a use of AI, but is an extension of what attackers have always done, is just automation, being able to move quickly once they get access. So from the time they get that initial access, especially ransomware operators, they're going to exfiltrate data and they're going to try and encrypt your systems. And anything that improves their automation and scale is going to allow them to do that faster and to more targets. So AI and large language models are just an example of another way that they can accelerate. On the defensive side, I know that at Fortinet we've already added a LLM advisor, so we call it Fortinet Advisor, to our SIEM and to our SOAR, FortiSIEM and FortiSOAR solutions. So that enables you to accelerate and help automate some of your data analysis, and ask the advisor to handle some of those analysis steps or collate data for you much more quickly. So it's helping to take some of the load off of your SOC analysts and hopefully allow them to scale a little better, reduce the analyst fatigue that you're dealing with.
No, I think we hear a lot about those types of tools, and I do think that's going to be a huge step forward for industrial cybersecurity, especially when we look at some of these smaller enterprises who maybe just don't have the bandwidth, understand the need, but they can use some of these types of tools that AI provides in really strengthening a number of different areas of their cyber defense.
I agree. And I think for those kinds of smaller organizations, it's also worth looking at, you know, can I hand some of this off to another organization? Can I have a service where I know that at Fortinet, we have our FortiGuard SOC as a service offering that's actually, you know, SOC sounds like something that's more of an enterprise thing. It's actually designed for smaller organizations where they maybe don't have the number of security analysts they might want to be able to handle everything. So we can kind of act as a filter for them. So whether it's our service or whether it's from another MSSP, it's a great way for these smaller organizations to reduce the analyst load and not have to just say, okay, well, now I've got all this data coming in. My SIM's loading up with logs. Now what?
Yeah. Yeah. And that happens more than we'd probably want to admit in terms of just that overabundance of intelligence or data from in the enterprise and understanding what to do with it. You know, I think you bring up a great point there too, with some of these kind of continuing the conversation with some of these smaller organizations, whether it's using an MSP or trying to do more internally, there is a real need, especially on the OT side, for cybersecurity specialists. We've seen projections into the hundreds of thousands of unfulfilled jobs or unfilled positions right now, just within manufacturing. What is your take there? We know there's no silver bullet, okay? But what do you feel there are some steps that the industry can take to get more people into these positions or get more younger people interested in filling these types of jobs?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, so I think there's definitely, I see the same projections that you do of like lots of unfilled positions. I also see a lot of people, you know, open to work on LinkedIn who have this expertise and maybe are still not hired. So I'm not totally, you know, I'm not sure whether I agree with the, you know, there's a massive shortage if you've got all these super qualified people and not in the roles at the moment. So there's different areas we can take that on. Certainly, I do actually think that in terms of getting new people into this space, some of the media coverage, the things like the Die Hard movie or the recent, what's the Netflix movie where the boat gets hacked, right? Yeah. So stuff like that at least helps people with awareness that there are all these automated systems that are maybe at risk from cybersecurity incidents. And I also think that what's been helpful over the past few years is that there's been a real explosion in terms of the number of resources, things like CTFs that people can get into. I know a lot of analysts that I've worked with early in my career where we had, you know, security services, device assessment services, pen testing services. These people are all over these kinds of activities of just being able to, like, you know, view it as like a competitive thing, show their skills, learn more about the space. I know people who came from they got a computer science diploma from college, and then they pivoted into OT cybersecurity by going through CTFs and those kinds of challenges. So I do think it's great having those out there. I will say, as a, you know, like a small plug for Fortinet, we have a huge Fortinet training institute, and the first few levels of that are freely available to anybody in terms of understanding the basic security landscape, understanding what a lot of the key defensive technologies are that are out there to protect different parts of, whether it's SaaS, cloud infrastructure, enterprise, or OT.
Excellent. You know, you're right. You know, you look on LinkedIn and the ethical hacker community, the penetration testing community, there is some incredible talent out there. The way that they want to work on a day-to-day basis may require a little bit of structural flexibility, but it will be worth it in getting working with those folks, because they function, they think differently, but the benefits that they bring really for the industry as a whole and potentially for a single organization are incredible. So maybe we need to break down our paradigms a little bit in how we embrace these folks if we want to bring them internally.
For sure. And I mean, I realize that there are some, yeah, I guess the diplomatic way would be to say that you got unique individuals in this space, and some of them have incredible skills, but maybe it's hard to slot them in and just say, okay, we need you to punch a clock and work these hours inside the SOC, right? That's not going to be for everybody. Absolutely. But at the same time, I've worked with people, you know, who are in co-op positions and just kind of showed an aptitude and an enthusiasm for security testing, and then have pivoted into maybe doing analyst roles inside. You know, I know somebody that I worked with in the past who's now in an analyst role at FortiGuard Labs, helping to provide the protections that go out to all of our customers. So, you know, starting from a almost like a QA co-op role, and then transitioning and showing an aptitude for this type of work.
Absolutely. So, Rod, this has been fantastic. We've covered a ton of different stuff. Sort of wrapping things up here, I'll give you the traditional closing question. Just want to know, as you look down the road a bit, what do you think are some of the bigger trends that we should be aware of, maybe 12, 18 months out?
I think the big ones for me are things like digital transformation, which I think is going to continue to accelerate for a lot of organizations. One of the big trends that we saw really that came to my attention last year, and that I think is definitely going to continue, is OT organizations becoming more comfortable with using cloud infrastructure, moving more functions into the cloud. So not just, you know, the traditional industrial IoT kind of, let's analyze the data in the cloud. And, you know, that makes sense. Let's store and forward the data out of the environment, do some analysis in the cloud, you know, maybe data historian in the cloud. We're now getting HMI in the cloud. We're now getting the ability for the cloud to make changes in the operational environment. So we're really seeing more organizations becoming comfortable with that just as part of their infrastructure. And I think companies are really going to have to think about how they apply security around those services that are coming from the cloud or that are being delivered there, because they can't rely on, they may have a direct pathway back down into the critical environment, and not the same kind of segmentation approach that they had before.
No, I'm glad you brought up that last part. That's what I was going to say. I'm a huge advocate of the cloud and using all of its resources, but sometimes I think there's a dump it in the cloud and forget about it dynamic, and you got to take care of security up there too. You don't just rely on Amazon or Google or Microsoft or whoever you're working with there.
Exactly. Or the SaaS, if you're using a SaaS platform based on one of those, then you've also got to ask some tough questions about how that's actually set up. You know, how they're handling multi-tenancy, what happens if, if somebody finds a vulnerability in their instance, are they able to pivot into other accounts, take over your gear? We've seen lots of examples where that has been true, where somebody's able to sort of pop out of one account or intercept some of the communications to from the cloud and take over other devices that don't belong to them, right? Because that's how the natural thing for the SaaS provider is just to build one big application and rely on user permissions to do everything. And that can be maybe not quite enough for your requirements, depending on what you expect.
Thanks, Rod. For more information on the work his company does, you can check him out at fortinet.com. Thank you for joining us today. And to catch up on past episodes, you can go to manufacturing.net, IEN.com, or mbtmag.com. You can also check Security Breach out wherever you get your podcasts, including Apple, Amazon, and Overcast. And if you have a cybersecurity story or topic that you'd like to have us explore in Security Breach, you can reach me at jeff@ien.com. For Rod Locke, I'm Jeff Ranke, and this is Security Breach.